Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of January. It's all things political for this Monday. It's the day before the President's State of the Union address. We have a little bit of a hint of what he's going to be talking about, and he has said in a message that he wrote to Democrats that his number one focus is going to be making sure that we are competitive and we are creating jobs, not just now, but well into the future. He said that his goal is to improve the economy for the entire American family. We'll discuss what both of our guests believe the president should be talking about tomorrow night and what you think the president should talk about as well. We'll have two guests during this hour, half hour. Charles Lipson joining us the first half hour, professor of political science and director of the program on international politics, economics, and security at the University of Chicago. Jonathan Alter will also join us, senior editor of Newsweek and author of the just released in paperback, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Charles Lipson, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to talk to you, Kathleen.
Your team lost yesterday. We are sorry.
Well, you know, mighty Casey has struck out. You know, what's so interesting to me about the rivalry is that it's just as strong here in Chicago as it is in Wisconsin. Normally, if you're in Boston, for example, you can hear Red Sox fans talking about the Yankees all the time, but you go to Manhattan and you rarely hear any talk of Boston. And I can go on about big city, little city, but in fact, the rivalry is just as strong here, and people were very much down in the dumps, including the current speaker.
Oh, I'm sorry, but we're happy. Well, now you'll have to root
for them. Your team just played better. They were just a better team.
They were. So will you root for them now?
I will, but I listened to our linebacker, Brian Urlacher, and he just said, I just hope that they lose the Super Bowl. I mean, you know, so it's a rivalry. It's a genuine rivalry. But I'm one of those White Sox fans who wants to see the Cubs win, not lose. And I'm a Bears fan who would like to see the Packers win it all.
All right. Well, you're a perfect guest for our show this morning, then. Thank you. The president's giving his State of the Union address. His number one focus, he said, is going to be making sure we're competitive and we're creating jobs. Do you have a hint as to how he plans on doing that? And should that be the number one focus?
It should be the number one focus. Well, it should be the number one focus along with the budget and tax policy. But in fact, he said it last year, and it ended up being very much a year in which I wouldn't say the recession continued, but a very slow recovery continued. We see him tilting to the center now. This makes sense, not only because the voters spoke, but also because basically the policies of the Obama administration ran into a fiscal roadblock. They were all premised on spending more and taxing more, and those have run into fiscal limits.
Mm-hmm. And he's likely to address deficit reduction, which, of course, the House Republicans are very interested in. Let's talk about this for a little while. Does the debt really need to be addressed? Can you address the debt when you are simultaneously trying to stimulate the economy?
Well, this is the $64,000 or trillion-dollar question. In fact, the main spokesperson on the other side is actually Wisconsin's own Paul Ryan,
yes,
who will be delivering the response, the Republican response to this State of the Union. And, of course, I'll be watching and listening carefully to both the president and to Representative Ryan, who I think is obviously a rising star.
Yes, he is.
A rising star not just because he is well-spoken and so forth, but a rising star because he just obviously knows his material and is a serious, serious student of public policy.
Mm-hmm. And the president has a great deal of respect for him as well.
Well, yes, and I think that this is a case where there really are very fundamental differences about the way in which the government ought to interact with the economy. I think it's a case where the president came in, essentially had a European-style government, does a lot of directing. The government's going to be deeply involved in the economy. There's going to be a lot more spending. There was a fundamental choice in terms of stimulating the economy. When the president came in, everybody knew that something needed to be done. You could either spend a lot of federal money or you could cut taxes and let people spend it themselves. And the president made his choice, and I think the voters have responded by saying that that choice didn't work out very well.
If he had not done that, though, there are others who said that we were on the bridge of a collapse here and that the bailout not only of auto companies but of Wall Street was absolutely necessary. What do you think?
I think that you need to distinguish between the bailout of the banks, which was necessary to prevent a kind of domino effect of collapsing banks, and two other things. One is the bailout of industrial corporations, which was largely a bailout of specific companies and union contracts that were associated with them and very heavy obligations that they had. That's different. And then the large stimulus package, that's also completely different from TARP. So the TARP, which was originally intended for the banks, ended up being used also for automobile companies, and then the massive public spending around the stimulus was essentially borrow $1 trillion from the Chinese, spend it on government projects and see if you get much employment. And what we know is we didn't get much employment. And when you look even at the administration's figures, the cost for each additional person employed was very, very high. So the issue is not whether the government was going to do anything, but how they were going to do it.
The unemployment rate, 8.2% in February of 2009, when the president first addressed Congress. It is now at 9.4% at last report. When he says he's going to concentrate on creating jobs now, do you have a plan that he might listen to? How should he do that? How is that rate going to be lowered?
I don't have a plan. I don't propose plans. I sort of listen to what politicians say and try to give my sense of whether they'll work, whether there'll be political support for them. I don't view myself primarily as a protagonist, but more as an analyst of what they're doing. And I've been, I must say that I think that the most important thing that the president can do would be to reduce some of the uncertainty associated with a lot of the regulations that have been piling on. I also think there's tremendous uncertainty now surrounding the health care bill.
You think that it's in trouble? Do you think it will be repealed by the Supreme Court?
It's possible that it will be found unconstitutional. I would say there's a 50-50 chance of that, and the reason for that is that there's never been a finding before. It enters new constitutional grounds primarily on the issue of the individual mandate. The individual mandate is absolutely crucial to the whole program. The program can't be funded without it. Basically, if you say as part of the law that anybody with pre-existing condition is allowed to buy insurance, then what will happen if you don't require everybody to buy insurance is that people will wait until they have a serious illness, and then while they're on the stretcher on the way to the hospital, they'll buy insurance, or just after they've been diagnosed with a serious illness, they'll buy insurance, or maybe when they're in the hospital, they'll buy insurance. In other words, if you allow people to buy house insurance when their house is on fire, they won't buy house insurance earlier, but or at least insurance against fire earlier. That's a problem. But the laws in the United States have never required an individual who is not doing anything to buy something. In other words, you do have to buy insurance when you drive a car, but that's associated first with your seeking permission to drive a car, for which you need a license, and secondly, it's directly related to the concept of driving. It's a foreseeable element of driving and providing for foreseeable accidents. But what's being asked in the health care bill is that simply because you get up and put on your underwear in the morning, you will have to buy a product. And if the government can require you to do that, say its opponents, then they can require you to do anything. And one of the most fundamental elements of the United States that most people have agreed on for 225 years is that we have a government of limited and specified powers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is unlimited powers. I mean, in other words, if they can require you to buy this, say the opponents, then why can't they require you to buy a Chevy Volt?
We had a guest last week who said it's all going to turn on Anthony Kennedy. Do you agree?
I think it will. Probably turn on Anthony Kennedy. But it's also the case that the Supreme Court pays some attention to the way that the public has shifted on this, and the fact that more than half the states are now parties to the lawsuit trying to repeal this, the fact that it's the public is very much divided on this, seems to be slightly against it. It depends on how you ask the question, but the public has certainly not supported this. Nancy Pelosi and others who said the more that people learn about the health care bill, the more they'll like it. That has turned out not to be true. They like certain aspects of it. They like being able to keep their young adult children on their own policies. They like not being able to being protected against insurance companies throwing them off, and they like some of the other protections, pre-existing conditions. But the overall policy they are very skeptical of, and they are particularly skeptical of the idea that you can add basically 30 plus million people to all aspects of the system without adding any additional supply of doctors or medical facilities, nurses, other professionals, and not expect there to be all kinds of shortages in the system. And we're already seeing all kinds of problems entering. We also, it's a 2,000-page law, but people...
Right.
Also expect as many as 100,000 pages of regulations to be associated with it. I'm just saying this is not a problem that's going to go away. In other words, the president is going to be talking about jobs. This is going back to your original point. The president's going to be talking about jobs and competitiveness, and I think he's moving toward a more friendly, business-friendly attitude. But I don't think that these other issues are going to go away.
And finally from me, before we go to phone calls, do you think that he will talk about gun policy in this country? A lot of people are asking that he do so in the wake of Tucson.
He may very well. I thought that there were two aspects of the Tucson shooting that deserved special attention. The first one is, I think, a widespread and quite proper public recognition that if our public officials don't feel free to meet with their constituents, to meet with the public, then our democracy is in peril. That simply can't happen. We need to provide whatever security and so forth there is. The second is that there was a lot of attention drawn to what is clearly two failures in our system. One is that people who have identifiable mental problems seem to have no problems getting guns. I think that there would be widespread support for doing something to change that. The other is that there's been a real shift for the worse in our mental health system over the last 20 or 30 years. We've sort of opened up the mental health facilities, let everybody go, mostly as a cost-saving measure, and people who clearly need to be hospitalized, there's almost no way to do it if they don't want to just go in. I mean, it's hard to say. I can't diagnose this person, but it seems like there are serious mental illnesses there.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest the first half hour of All Things Political is Professor Charles Lipson, Professor of Political Science, Director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. We have to be sure to ask him about Afghanistan and policy there, the transfer of troops from Iraq to Afghanistan, and whether or not it's making any difference. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, please do. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Monday will be talking about the state of mental health care in the United States. Phone call is now for Professor Charles Lipson, Mike in Appleton, our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I have a comment and a question. I agree with the professor that, you know, the number one problem going forward for the creation of jobs is what I believe to be an absolute lack of confidence from the business community in the government and, you know, what their plans are. I mean, it's so obvious that they've changed their tune because they got, as the president said, a shellacking in this last election, but you know, businesses don't make plans for a year or two. They try to make plans for 5-10 years in the future. And I see a tremendous amount of uncertainty out there and people really dubious about, you know, what to do. And my question for the professor is the following. There's a group of people, probably, you know, tens of millions of them, who are probably around 50 years old and over, who are people who have lost the jobs that they had and whose jobs are not coming back. And retraining an older person is not an easy thing to do. What's going to happen with that group of people? That's going to be a huge social problem.
It's a tremendous... You've identified two things. One, I think we're in agreement that the uncertainties... There's some uncertainties that just surround the economy. Those are going to be hard for the government to deal with, but there are additional uncertainties that are piled on by government policies. By the way, I think that what you're likely to see on most big policies is essentially a stalemate now that the House is under Republican control. The Senate is essentially divided. You need kind of supermajorities to move, and the president is largely opposed to what the House is going to do. I think that there's a serious problem in retraining people, but this is basically as difficult as it is in the U.S. The U.S. is in better position than most of our competitors because we have a flexible job market. I think that what the president and his education secretary, who I think has done an excellent job, Arne Duncan, have focused on is community colleges. To the extent that people need retraining, the place that's best situated in the economy to do that are community colleges. But I mean, I think Mike has put his finger right on it. It's just really hard if you're 55, 60 years old, for 30 years you've done one thing and it's been replaced. I should just add that it's not that it's always replaced by foreign competition. If you think about what most people in Wisconsin did 150 years ago, most people in Wisconsin were farmers, right? They haven't been replaced by foreign competition. They've been replaced by technology.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. Mary in Janesville, hi.
Good morning. I just want to address the gun thing very quickly. I know we've passed that, but I am not a member of the NRA. I really oppose their policies, but I have been a gun owner in the past, and I may be a gun owner in the future again. I'm not really sure. I don't know. It all depends on whether or not I decide to start shooting trap again. But the point is, people can get guns. Legislation doesn't stop people from getting guns. They can get guns. And insofar as the economy, here in Wisconsin, we've just taken a real hit. We have a new governor who has decided that it's not a good idea to look to the future of putting railroad through Wisconsin. And so that particular thing has been taken off the table for a long-term project that could have benefited our state. I don't see our state as being unique in that. I'm sure that there are things like that happening all over the country. And so I think we have to appeal to people at state level to make sure that they're electing the people who are going to make the economic choices that they need in order to keep their state strong. And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Mary, I think that those are excellent points. I think the first point is obvious to any of us who live in Chicago or Milwaukee and so forth, where there you can have any restrictions you want on the legal purchase of guns, but local gangs and the rest are going to be well-armed, and it's a problem. I think that given the strength of the NRA and given the fact that the Republicans control the House, there won't be anything big that can be done on guns. And you haven't heard for the past several years, you haven't heard the Democrats put any really emphasize that issue. So what might be done in the aftermath of Tucson would be something related to mental health and guns. On the other issue, I think that if there was such a huge stimulus program, the thing that would have been one of the things that would have been best to do with it was not to move to short-term stimulus, but to look to the long-term infrastructure of the country. I mean, if you ask what has helped grow the country over the last 50 years, one of the great stimulators has been the interstate highway system begun in the mid-50s by President Eisenhower. So we need highways, we need trains, we need bridges, but all that money has been spent. And I think the final point here is the states are really a laboratory for democracy, and we are going to see whether the policies that the state of Illinois, with essentially a liberal Democratic governor who has just raised taxes by what,
two-thirds,
67%, versus Wisconsin and Indiana next door, which are going the opposite direction, trying to create a more business-friendly environment. We'll see which one works best.
Finally, I need to ask you about Afghanistan before we change guests here. The president has moved troops from Iraq to Afghanistan. Is there a successful endpoint in sight here, do you think?
We don't even know what success would look like. The president has declined to talk to the public for really 2 years about the war that he said was the most important war. The big decision that was made a couple of years ago was to not go with Joe Biden's plan, which was essentially a low use special forces, use drones and the like, but rather put more people on the ground and see if we could firm up, at least knock out the Taliban. And the problem is we're working with a very corrupt and seemingly incompetent government there. I think the biggest foreign policy question of the coming year is going to be Afghanistan and Iran. The breakdown of talks last week with Iran and the fact that they're ramping up, clearly trying to ramp up to get a nuclear weapon, and the United States has to make decisions about what it's going to do, given that President Obama's efforts, sincere efforts, to reach out and open a hand to them have been clearly rejected by them.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Lipson. Hope you enjoy the Super Bowl.
My pleasure.
Okay.
My pleasure. I hope the Packers win.
Thank
I really
you, Charles.
Do. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Professor Charles Lipson, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. It just so happens that both our guests this hour are Bears fans. Jonathan Alter joining us the next part of this conversation, Senior Editor of Newsweek and author of The Promise, President Obama Year One. This book has just been released in paperback just last week, and so we're going to be talking about the State of the Union address, which will be tomorrow night. And by the way, we will be carrying that address here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And of course, the president is coming to Wisconsin to drum up support for what he talks about in the State of the Union address. And I believe we'll have Don Gagne with us, who's going to be with the president in Wisconsin on Wednesday to be one of our guests responding to the president's remarks. And we're welcoming phone calls again this half hour. So whatever you wanted to say to Professor Lipson, we'll be talking about much of this with Jonathan Alter this half hour as well. The economy, the creation of jobs, which the president plans to say a great deal about in the State of the Union, the foreign policy, his tilting to the center, as Professor Lipson was talking about, has that resulted in his in poll numbers going up? And we'll also be talking about gun control. There are many people who are saying that a ban on assault weapons should be reinstituted as a result of the Tucson shootings. And then there were more shootings over the weekend at a Walmart and in Detroit. So we'll be talking about that with Jonathan as well. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address remains talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We're just getting him, we hope, on the line here very soon and welcoming more phone calls. We can also ask him to comment briefly, although it's not the focus of all things political, but he has appeared with Keith Olbermann, who is no longer with MSNBC, appeared frequently with him, so we can ask his thoughts about his departure from MSNBC, and I hope that we can have him soon. In the meantime, I guess what we could do is just take a few of your phone calls on all things political, those issues that you were not able to have a chance to speak with Charles about. You can certainly call right now, and we can do that while we're waiting for Jonathan. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. And again, our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We will have State of the Union response, of course, on Wednesday morning. And we're going to be talking the second hour of the program. Our guest the first half hour mentioned mental health and how the Tucson shooter really fell through the cracks here and should have been getting some kind of mental health treatment. We'll look at the state, and it's not a very good picture here of how services for mental health have been cut across the board, all over this country. And so we will talk about that. Jonathan Alter is with us now. His book, The Promise, President Obama Year One, has just been released in paperback. Jonathan Alter, hello.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Our second Packer, or not, I'm sorry, Packer, you're not. Our second Bears fan. I'm
You had to remind me. I had enough pain yesterday afternoon.
Did you really?
You know, I grew up just a few blocks from Wrigley Field where the Bears used to play when I was a kid in the 60s, and I would go over to Bears games, and I've been a Bears fan ever since, but this was a sorry performance.
Yeah, it was. We're so sorry.
You're not.
It's amazing. It's like a religion in this state, Jonathan. People are just, you know, depressed if they lose, and they're gloriously happy if they win. It's just amazing.
I get it.
Yeah, you get it. So you will root for the Packers and the Super Bowl?
I will root for the Packers, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know what? You know, for the purposes of this broadcast, yes, I will root for the Packers.
We'll hear what you say in other broadcasts then. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. And out of Midwestern loyalty. Yes.
Okay. Good.
It
good.
Helps people buy my book.
There
yes,
you go.
I understand now.
There you go. All right. We like that. So since you wrote the book, do you think the president has tilted a great deal to the center?
I think he has some. I think he's always been a pragmatic politician, and this was something a lot of people misunderstood about him. They read things into him that they wanted, and so they assumed all kinds of things that he had never promised. I mean, I met some liberals who actually thought that he was going to, not go fight in Afghanistan. And through the whole campaign, he kept saying, we're going to get out of Iraq and go into Afghanistan. Some people weren't listening, so I don't think that he's had any kind of radical transformation in his politics, but what happened was in the shellacking of the midterm elections, he lost independents, and he had won them in 2008, and in order to get them back, he had to move to the center. So you saw him cooperating in the lame duck session, and they got a lot of legislation through, including a number of things that were good for liberals, ratifying START and, of course, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And even in the tax package, which, over his objections, certainly mine, extended tax cuts for the wealthy, there was an awful lot of tax relief for middle-income and even lower-middle-income folks in that package that didn't get very much attention.
Mm-hmm. I thought this president certainly knows how to give a speech. His remarks in Tucson in a situation that was less than favorable for giving a heartfelt address in that huge stadium with so many people applauding, he was just really moving in that address. He did what he had to do to acknowledge everybody and move people through a national sorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that speech was almost pitch perfect and reminded everybody of why Barack Obama became president in the first place.
Yes.
But one of the great surprises that I experienced in writing The Promise was that over the last couple of years, we expected him to ace communications because of those skills that he showed and struggle in executive leadership because he had so little experience coming to the presidency. And yet, for most of the time, it's ironically been the reverse of that. He has struggled to communicate, to inspire, and yet he's gotten much more done than anybody had reason to expect and has put more points on the board, to use his sports metaphor, than any president since Lyndon Johnson. I think a lot of that, though, didn't get communicated. And one of the things I try to do in The Promise is to, not just explain what happened behind the closed doors of the Oval Office or the Cabinet Room or the Situation Room, but to give you kind of a scorecard on what he got done that he promised and where he fell short. just give people more information to make their own judgments about this man.
So how do you explain that, the fact that he can knock a speech out of the park and yet hasn't been able to – he has done some, I think, to be remembered forever speeches. But he's well, how could somebody like this fall short on that?
Well, as Valerie Jarrett told me, you know, she's one of his top aides, and I talked to not just the president and vice president, but all the top people around them for the book. She said, you know, we just never found the right vocabulary on health care. I think most of the problem on the communications front was that they didn't really explain health care very well, and it was complicated, but they just fell short there in developing the right arguments. And then in the midterm elections, they didn't develop a coherent message. Now, why did that happen? I would argue that part of it is that the president is allergic to sound bites.
Mm.
He thinks that they sound phony.
Mm-hmm.
And his authenticity is very important to him, and he thinks it's important to him politically to not come across as a sloganeer. But what he forgets is that if you look back in history, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Franklin Roosevelt, that was a soundbite.
Right.
Or a house divided against itself cannot stand. Abraham Lincoln, that was a soundbite. And so I think the president would be, you know, well advised to come up with some lines that can be chiseled in marble, or at least tweeted. You know, something that people can remember and get their arms around, and then he'll be able to communicate a little bit better.
What have you been told is he likely to talk about tomorrow?
Well, it's going to be a speech that's very focused on growth, he's moving from, you know, essentially an emergency crisis atmosphere, particularly in 2009, to looking more toward the long term and helping the United States compete again in the global economy. So this is going to be a speech about innovation nation. And you're going to hear that word growth many times. And he's going to try to tie things like education, where he's made some real progress, to the economy, and explain that if we continue to lag behind in education, we're not going to be able to train the workforce of the future to maintain our standard of living. So I think he's going to try to tell a story about where the country needs to go economically. And of course, he will refer to the Tucson shootings, and as I understand it, Mark Kelly, the husband of Gabrielle Giffords, is going to be sitting with Michelle Obama in the balcony. So there will be some sad moments, but this is his best venue. And some presidents are best sitting in the Oval Office giving a televised address.
Yes.
This president is best with an audience, particularly congressional audience. And so on health care, for instance, where, as I said, he didn't communicate well overall, you may recall that he had a very successful speech quoting Ted Kennedy in September of 2009 that helped get health care over the finish line. So I think you can expect that this will be pretty successful. He's already on the way up in the polls, and it's an important moment. He may, as he has in a recent speech, call it a Sputnik moment, in reference to the Russians launching the first satellite into space on October 4th, 1957. The reason I know the date is that it was 2 days before I was born.
Oh, my.
And what that did is, in the United States, that kicked off a whole new effort to beef up math and science education and start the space race, which ended up yielding all kinds of benefits in computers and materials and all sorts of other things. So I think he wants us to, get moving again in becoming a nation that can do great things. And he has the inspirational abilities to do that. I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the way he frames or doesn't frame a message, as well as trying to take readers behind the closed doors of other important decisions that he made.
Let's go to phone calls. We have a full bank waiting to speak with you. Jonathan Alter, our guest this half hour, senior editor of Newsweek, author of The Promise, President Obama, Year One, which has just been released in paperback. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Jonathan, thank you. I've learned a lot from your work.
Oh, thanks.
I wanted to bring up the State of the Union. This year, there's going to be people from the left and people from the right sitting next to each other, I guess dozens. But some on the right are saying that this is just a way for the left to keep us from speaking out during the State of the Union, and reminded me of Joe Wilson's with the You Lie thing. Now, he raised a lot of money when he did that.
Right.
And, you know, what kind of incentive do you think that there are for some of these people on the right, some of these elected officials, who need some cash and are inclined to yell and shout and disturb the State of the Union? Do you see that as something that is possibly going to happen?
Well, you can't ever rule anything out. I think it's less likely, given the post-Tucson mood, that you're going to see that this year. And certainly not from Joe Wilson. You know, I tell the story in The Promise of how after the You Lie episode, Wilson decided that he still wanted to go to the White House Christmas party and have his picture taken with the president. You know? these guys are playing to their constituents at home, many of whom are quite conservative and anti-Obama, but they also realize they have to function in Washington. I'm very intrigued by this this idea of them sitting together, and it'll be interesting to watch the dynamics because, you know, for many years, the State of the Union has become kind of a pep rally,
mm-hmm.
And you see one side of the aisle jumping up and then the other side of the aisle leaping to their feet, and so it's going to be a little bit harder to tell who's cheering for what with them mixed in, but I think it's a good symbolic move and a sign that there are at least some people in Washington who want to lower the temperature and work together, and certainly the president is among them.
We go. Thanks, Dave. Don in West Salem. Hi, Don.
Yes, good morning.
Hi. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to say that with all this talk about gun control and such, I think people have the right to protect themselves, but then again, I don't really see any difference between the guy that killed those people and shot the politician than the governor of Arizona. If the politician that had gotten shot hadn't had any insurance, the governor would have let her die. It's become quite obvious that life doesn't mean anything to her unless you have money.
Jonathan.
Well, I am not a Jan Brewer fan. I certainly wouldn't make the comparison that you just made, but I do think it is a striking development in our politics that in Arizona they're saying that, they won't pay for a transplant, in one case, a man in his 40s with four children. And, you know, it's a fend-for-yourself kind of environment down there. And so I don't believe in linking politicians to what a sane individual did in Tucson. I just think that gets everybody off track when you start doing that, whether it's Sarah Palin or anybody else. But I do think it's important to understand that this is not your father's Republican Party. You know, your father's Oldsmobile. This is not the Republican Party of Barry Goldwater in Arizona. They've gone, even though Barry Goldwater was against Medicare and Social Security, they've just gone off in a right-wing direction that you're right to be concerned about.
Her comments, though, to me, seem pretty heartfelt after this shooting. She does seem to be a friend of Congresswoman Giffords. And
oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's why I hope I made it clear.
Oh, that, you did make it clear.
That,
yeah,
that the caller,
you did.
I thought was, you know, honestly out of bounds.
Right.
Trying to suggest any comparison between Brewer's policies and that tragedy. And no, she's been sympathetic.
Yeah, but do you think it begs the question here, or calls for the question as to whether or not the president should and will talk about a renewed ban on assault weapons tomorrow night?
It's one of the real moments of suspense, I think. And I don't know the answer to the question. The way it works for me and this kind of thing is that I can go back a few weeks later and find out what really happened behind the scenes and the preparation of a speech like this, and then put it in my book. And I did a lot of that in The Promise. But before it happens, they're very tight-lipped. And we don't know what he'll say. My guess is that he will defend gun rights and Second Amendment rights, and then say that it's time to renew the assault weapon ban that we used to have, which prevented these high-capacity clips, you know, so where you can get off 30 rounds. Without reloading, that doesn't have anything to do with protecting yourself from an intruder or hunting, or all that's good for is killing, and nobody but police have any need for it. So, I mean, I hope he does that. It's interesting that even Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal urged him to do that. So we'll see.
Yeah. Jonathan Alter, our guest for a couple more minutes, senior editor of Newsweek, author of just released in paperback, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have time for maybe one or two more phone calls. Mike in South Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I've been listening to this, and I have a few comments. First, about the quest for more education to move forward, or whatever the term was, that's a joke. I have many friends, I'm in my 60s, many friends younger than me and friends of my daughters in their 20s, graduates of very fine universities with very fine educations who can't get jobs.
All right, let's hold it to that because we're almost out of time. How will the president and how should the president address job creation tomorrow night?
Well, I guess I would disagree with the caller that education is a joke. Unemployment for those with college degrees is only 5% in this country.
Mm.
And, my heart goes out to that 5%, but it's much, much higher, as we know, for those who haven't been to college. So education, I think, will continue to be the key to job growth long term. In the short term, which is what we're all concerned about right now, we have to figure out a way to free up credit. The banks are sitting on huge amounts of money that they're not lending to small business, so small business can't go out and create jobs. And that's the engine of job creation in this country. And then on top of that, and this is something I just wrote a column about on Bloomberg News, you have big businesses which are stiffing small businesses that they owe money to, and they aren't paying their bills for 60, 90, 120 days to the small businesses, which are then suffocating. So I don't think the president will refer to that in that level of specificities to some things that need to go differently in small business, but he he will talk about a small business agenda, and he will talk about other ways of using tax policy to encourage job growth and trade promotion, which encourages job growth because so many of our jobs are related to exports. So
mm-hmm.
you're going to hear a fair amount of economic talk in this speech, and he'll probably try to draw the same distinction I just did between short-term remedies and long-term necessities.
15 seconds left. Is Keith Olbermann going to land up somewhere else?
My understanding is that not right away, that the terms of his parting from MSNBC prevent him from going back on the air right away, but I would be amazed if you didn't see him back on television fairly soon. And he's a tremendous broadcaster. And whatever one thinks of his politics, you've got to admire his ability to pop on television.
He's smart. Jonathan Alter, a pleasure to have you as always. His book, The Promise, President Obama Year One, has just been published in paperback. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show, Chrissy Peace on air production.